You can't start the car. Johnny has the keys.
Hello, hello, and welcome out there in podcast and YouTube land. You have landed on Johnny Has the Keys, a podcast and YouTube channel that we do weekly, talking about horror, science fiction, films, television, literature sometimes, the key influences on that particular piece of genre, and the influences that it then gave to other genre pieces. If you are finding us for the first time, wow, we are glad you're here, and we hope that you'll return. As a matter of fact, we'll hope while you're visiting right now, you might want to go ahead and subscribe on YouTube or ring the bell or hit or give us a review, especially if you can give us a review on Apple. Apple tends to elevate the reviews a lot, and that way we can get a lot more people listening and a lot more shared fans who enjoyed this. If you are returning, yay, we did something right, and you're back to see us, and you'll notice something a little different about the look of today's episode or today's podcast. We are honored. My name is David, by the way. Tim is here as normal, as my normal co-host and co-conspirator. But this week, we are joined by the first ever guest on Johnny Has the Keys, Tyler Mack, a fellow podcaster, a fellow actor, a fellow friend, a fellow genre, and all things nerdish lover. He is known as the, he resides in the fortress of nerditude. He is nerdalicious all over the place, and we are so happy to have him. Tyler, welcome.
Hello.
To Johnny Has the Keys.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. What have you been up to? What have you been doing?
Oh, Hell Week. For
Hell Week. Okay. Yes. You're opening a theater show.
Yes. Yes. A theater show. It's, I'm sure you've seen it on social media. If you follow me, I've been doing a lot of different marketing posts, but it's called Cry Havoc, and it is an original script written by our tech director at Walter State, Wes Downing. And basically, you know, Mark McGinley. You remember,
yes,
Mark.
I did.
It was a concept that they were working on when they were still in school together. And it's a comedy about like two professors, one of literature, one of theater, arguing about the many fights throughout Shakespearean repertoire. And one professor, my character, is trying to make the point that the paying attention to the combat sequences and making them bigger than the actual show, as some directors tend to do, you know, they take the words they fight and they expound on it in a ridiculous manner, helps you become a better chess player. And he's trying to prove this point, and it jumps in and out of different Shakespearean combat sequences like Hamlet and Romeo and Juliet and the Scottish play. And
well, you can say it. We're not in a theater.
I don't say it anytime. It's just safer that way.
Tim will say it.
I'll let loose those dogs of war. You watch.
But it's a lot of fun. It's a show within a show. It's a very meta show. Wes has written it as very meta, which I love meta things. A lot of fourth wall breaking for my character. And moments with the audience that other characters don't see. So I get to basically be like Deadpool in that fashion.
Okay.
And a lot of great fight scenes. TJ Kent, the director at Walter State, did all the fight sequences, and some of them get so in detail that he even had to realize, like, okay, you guys aren't professionals. Some of these moves I can't ask you to do because this is your first time holding a sword. I was like, well, you know, fun fact, when we did Camelot all those years ago, hundreds of years ago when I was at Walter State, Jerry Malloy just gave us a sword and said, here, I'm not going to teach you fighting. Have fun. I was like, so you're already doing more than that.
Wow.
Jerry Malloy. How long have we known him?
I actually, I throw in some Malloyisms. I pull for my theater teacher, I pull an ism from our Mr. Horton here that I've seen him do before. I pull from a Joe Powell, a Jerry Malloy, and some other teachers and directors that I've had. I kind of pull some isms to create this character.
Well, it sounds interesting. I mean, I've already got tickets. I'm looking forward to seeing the show. It's interesting because Tim and I, we've done Shakespeare before. Twice, Tim?
Yeah.
We did Romeo.
No, we did Taming of the Shrew.
Taming and Macbeth. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Familiar with the Shakespeare, familiar with the fights, and familiar with the uniqueness of it. And
I got murdered on stage.
Yeah.
It was great.
You look good considering.
Before we go to Tim's week, Tyler, tell us a little bit, because one of the things that I neglected in your intro is you do have a really, really great podcast that you and Josh do, and you also were the very first ever Patreon supporter of Johnny Has the Keys. Yes. And so you have a unique distinction, and we just wanted to thank you for that and thank all of our Patreons. But also tell us a little bit about 30 and Nerdy. If people like Johnny and they want to jump over to the Nerdination, yeah, how do they do that?
We're on podcasts wherever you cast your pod. As we say, wherever you get great podcasts, you can find us there.
That sounds a little weird, but okay.
Cast your podcast. I wanted to say something. When I started saying that, I was like, what are people not saying?
Right, true. So, yeah. You have
I don't
to.
Think people are saying that. No. I picture like someone throwing a fishing lure into something, casting their pod.
Okay.
So if you were to do a digital thing, it would be like someone casting their headphones into the podcast realm and pulling up 30 and Nerdy, stuff like that.
The pod pool.
There you go.
The massive pod pool that there is out there. Mm. So it's been great. We recently reached like 10,300 downloads. And every time something like that happens, I look at Josh and I go, we're two boys from Morristown, Tennessee, just talking nerd stuff. And the fact that someone wants to listen, it's great. I mean, because these are the same conversations that we have, like in the car on the way to a WWE pay-per-view or a movie premiere or just talking on the couch at one of our houses. So, I mean, these are the same conversations that we have to just over on a mic now, and people listen. And one thing I'm really excited that we're about to do is our first watch through of something. Mm-hmm. And it came from this idea that I was taking my fiance Madison through some of the early DC stuff. So like Keaton's Batman. And then we got to Joel Schumacher's. And it gave Josh this idea of the redemption of Batman and Robin. And I was like, can we put a question mark at the end of that? Redemption? Question mark. And so we're going to watch it and commentate, very Mystery Science Theater, and try to find some redeeming qualities. There's not many that I could even in my last watch through say, well, that's a redeeming quality. Madison just gave me this look like she was questioning saying yes after seeing it. She was like, sure. I don't know if I want to do this for the rest of my life. That's one that we've got coming up. And of course, we're going to talk a lot about Doctor Strange coming up because we're getting close to the multiverse of madness within a matter of weeks. And of course, they just dropped the trailer for Thor 4, Love and Thunder. That's what we'll be talking. We'll be talking a lot of nerd stuff.
And you said, it's very interesting because you said these are conversations that you guys would have anyway. Yeah. You just happen to be recording them and putting them out there. And that's kind of how Tim and I started. Mm-hmm. And it's some of my favorite podcasts. That's what they are. Mm-hmm. They're people who love what they're talking about and just give it all their passion. And that, I think works in my opinion. I think those are my favorites. So what you were doing theater, Tim, what have you been doing? You've been scared. What, you watched five?
I wanted to comment on what you just said about past conversations. I would venture to say that any movie we cover that is pre-1990s is probably a conversation we had decades ago.
Oh, God, yeah.
And we're just kind of revisiting it on here.
Oh, yeah.
And then we haven't been really together in decades. So anything past the 90s or what we're jamming on now via the internet. So,
yeah, we've said it a couple of times on the podcast, Tyler, and I'm not even sure if you're aware of it, but Tim and I, you know, you and Josh actually also, you record at the same time, right? Like in the same room with each other. Yeah. You don't Zoom
after, in. After we got vaccinated and things started kind of loosening a little bit, we decided to get back together physically. Right. And I know what you're about to say, and I have to make a comment about it when you're done.
Okay.
So you're familiar enough to know that I'm going to say that Tim and I literally have not been in the same physical space in decades.
Yeah. way before this podcast started. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But now it's like, you know, he's weekly at least once. And, you know, that's not counting all the tweets and everything.
It doesn't feel that way. Like I've been listening to you all since you started. I mean, like the early days when you were doing the Haunting of Hill House run through and, you finally talked about your Evil Dead stories, which you came on the show and talked about with us, and I have to say it's one of the most listened to episodes we've had so far. So there is a lot of Evil Dead fans still out there, and it doesn't feel that way. It feels like even if you're not being in the physical room together, it feels like you all are. You've been together. Good. You maybe had dinner last week together, or it feels that way. It does not feel like you haven't been in the same room in 10 years.
Thank you. We appreciate that. And I'll share with other podcasters out there because, of course, we use these backgrounds that we have. There are occasionally times now when Tim will turn his background off or I'll turn my background off and we'll look at each other going, is that your room? Really? Is that what it looks
like? That's the choice you made? You know?
Really?
Yeah.
Tim, what have you been doing? It's a long intro, but we're having fun.
That's okay. It's a special episode.
It is.
On a very special episode of Johnny Has the Keys, Tim would like to talk about his new favorite movie from Thailand.
Oh, my God.
Tim watched The Pool. The reason it's my favorite movie from Thailand is it's the only movie from Thailand I've ever seen. It is currently playing on Shudder, and I would like to say you should watch this movie. It is actually very entertaining. There are a few, and I don't know if they're cultural differences as far as filmmaking technique or writing that stretch the bounds of logic, especially some stunt work where I was going, oh, no, there's no way that would happen. But it's still vastly entertaining. It is about a video shoot for I think it was a music video. It may have been a film in a gigantic Olympic swimming pool. And what I mean by gigantic is that it's 40 feet deep. It's really deep. And it's the wrap day. And one of the guys on the crew is waiting for his girlfriend. He floats out on a float. His friend is going to the airport to fly back to Bangkok, and they're draining the pool, and the guy has fallen asleep on a float in the pool, and when he wakes up, he's so far down, he can't get out. And amidst this, there is his dog is up on the decking, I guess you'd say, tied and waiting for his master to take him home. And there is somewhere like a radio broadcast that a crocodile has escaped from a local zoo. And before the water is completely gone, that crocodile falls into the pool. And the next thing you know, they are both trapped. It's an old abandoned pool. It was only used for the site. I mean, for the movie. And it's a battle of wits between this guy and a crocodile in an empty pool.
Okay.
And the fun ensues. So I will leave it at that. I was shocked. I thought this was going to be another Korean horror movie. You know how I watch so many of those. And when I found out it was from Thailand, I was like, wow, I didn't even know they were making films there. But that's great.
Yeah.
So.
Well, and it kind of, when I first saw the poster you've got there behind you, it kind of reminded me of The Host, you know, that sort of thing, a foreign feel to it, a very sepia tone blue kind of look, you know, interesting. But it basically turns out to be a, you know, man against shark story, man against
battle of the wits monster in the pool with a gator or a crocodile, that is. Yeah.
Okay.
It got really highly rated on Rotten Tomatoes, so that's why I checked it out. So.
You and Rotten Tomatoes. Why do you trust Rotten? Never mind.
Hey, it is a consensus of critics. You know, it's not one person.
Yeah, that says that Paddington Bear is the best movie ever
made.
Have you seen it, David?
No. No, but I guarantee it's not the best movie ever made.
What have you been doing?
I did a little smorgasbord sort of thing. So I'm also preparing for a show and doing that. So it eats up a lot of my time, as you know. But I did manage to catch a couple of episodes of Discovery because I've still got to catch up with my hatred. So I watched.
You're such a masochist.
Oh my gosh. And I keep hoping, you know, you and I have a sister podcast that, you know, for Patreon that is Star Trek, and you know, we love Star Trek, but oh my gosh, this series sucks so bad. Anyway, so then I started Picard because it has season two of Picard is out now. So I thought I'd watch it and got even as the same disappointment.
Star Trek died in 1982, David.
After Wrath of Khan, we don't watch anything else. But then I went back and looked at Battlestar Galactica, the reboot, I guess would be the best way to say it. The one that Brandon Braga did and everything. Mm-hmm. And it kind of reaffirmed my antithesis of my cynicism, because I tend to be very cynical and don't reboot anything, don't remake it. Jesus Christ, you're doing Batman again? God, you know, or whatever.
Yeah.
But Battlestar Galactica is a great example of how you can reinvent a property and do it in a way that still pays homage to the original without denigrating it and propels it forward in a different way, which I've heard is what the new Batman is like too. So I haven't seen it yet, but I'm curious to see if it
does that. Well, it's on HBO Max now.
It is on HBO. You can just go see it in your, but you know, movies, exactly. Theater, big screen for those kind of things. But anyway, so I was getting back to some sci-fi for a bit and trying to, you know, had two disappointments and then one. Yeah, you know, there is possibility out there.
I think the new Ghostbusters does that successfully. I enjoyed.
Could be. I haven't seen it yet either.
I think Jason did really well with that.
Yeah. Well, I have a great segue because earlier, Tyler, you mentioned Wes Downing mm-hmm. is the writer mm-hmm. of this piece you're doing. And you also said your entire script is very meta. Mm. So those two things are great transitions to what we're talking about today, right, Mr. Smith? I mean, you know, considering?
Well, if you haven't guessed.
Gather round.
If you haven't guessed by the backdrops that Tyler and I both have up, we are doing a very special broadcast of a very special film that was released in 1996 by a very special director, Mr. Wes Craven himself, the original Scream.
Surprise.
Scream. I guess I will go ahead and do a really quick synopsis before we dive into this little booger. This film opens in medias res very well, I must say, with a young woman named Casey who is at home alone cooking popcorn. She gets an unknown call from somebody that's kind of flirty. He reveals that her boyfriend, Steve, is on the patio and will be murdered if she doesn't answer a series of questions about horror movies correctly. Well, he basically throws a trick question at her about Friday the 13th, and it's lights out for Steve. Next thing you know, Casey is chased about by a man in a very hard to run in, I would think, costume and mask. And she is basically gutted and mutilated and left hanging in a tree for her parents to discover. We cut to the present where Sydney Prescott is the lead. She is played by Neve Campbell, and she is struggling with the first anniversary of her mother's rape and murder. There's a news reporter named Gail Weathers, who she dislikes because she spread rumors about her mother's murder and conspiracy theories. She makes an appearance, so she's introduced early on. And then later that evening, while Sydney is waiting for her friend Tatum to come over, she gets a call from the same taunter of Casey. She's attacked as well, but soon her friend Billy Loomis, or her boyfriend Billy Loomis, arrives. But when he drops his cell phone, suddenly Sydney suspects that maybe it was him that was the killer. So he ends up being arrested. And isn't that when, I think that's where he gets arrested. Mm-hmm. Sorry.
Mm-hmm.
The next day, though, he is released, and the suspicion shift to Sydney's father, who had gone out of town on a business trip but is now missing. School is suspended in wake of these murders, and the principal, played by the Fonz himself, is actually killed while the school is empty. Stu, the friend, there's a whole bunch of friends in here. We got Stu and Tatum and Sydney and Billy and some others, Randy. Stu decides he's going to throw a party to celebrate the closing of the school. Gail Weathers attends uninvited with Tatum's brother as his girlfriend, kind of. And he is Deputy Dewey, played by David Arquette in all Barney Rubble. It's not Barney Rubble. Barney Fife, Glory.
Fife.
Yeah. So there's this big party. And the rest of this movie is basically at this big party that happens. At one point, Tatum goes out in the garage. She finds the killer out there. He ends up killing her by trapping her in a doggy door in a garage and hitting the button and, I guess, breaking her neck as it rises.
Death by garage door. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Once news is out that the murder of the principal has happened, a lot of the students at the party go, woohoo, and they take off, leaving just a few folks there, including Sydney, Billy, Randy, Stu, and Gail's cameraman, Kenny. Mm. Billy decides, well, I guess Sydney decides that since Billy had not been guilty, she decides she's going to have sex with him. So she does, and right after they have sex, they are confronted by the killer. Sydney escapes, but the killer fatally slashes Billy's throat. Gail spectacularly crashes her van at some point in this, and Randy and Stu show up and accuse each other of being the killer. Am I losing anyone yet?
No, we're
okay.
I'm right there. Well, bloodbath happening everywhere. Right.
Sydney decides she's not going to take any chances. She goes to the house without them and locks the door and finds Billy fatally wounded. She gives Billy, mistakenly, the gun, and Billy lets Randy in and shoots him, revealing himself to be the killer. Then Stu comes out of the shadows with a little talk box that sounds like the voice from the phone and reveals that he indeed is also the killer. We have a double murderer. They confront her in the kitchen, tell her about their plans and how they're going to, that they were the ones that framed Cotton Weary with the most pilgrim sounding name I've ever heard in my life, for the murder of her mother. And this time they're going to frame her father for the murder. They have this really sadistic and strange way of trying to make themselves look innocent by stabbing each other and hurting each other. Billy goes a little too far with Stu, who feels like he may be dying. At one point, Sydney escapes with her father. Gail came to the door, and they escape.
Yeah.
They escape, and she ends up putting the costume on and starts playing the game with them, which I find a little unbelievable, but very, very cathartic. I enjoy that part of the film a lot. Things go bad for Stu, when Sydney knocks him to the floor and basically throws a television set on his head. So he is most likely dead. Billy comes back in the picture, but so does Gail. Gail shoots him. Randy, we find out, is alive. Randy, Gail, and Sydney look at Billy's dead body. Randy explains, this is when the killer always comes back. He rises, and they shoot Billy in the forehead. And I will come back to that because I have to say something about that that Tyler may even already suspect if I know he's probably seen the newest Scream movie. Anyway, that's how it ends. Basically, Dewey is taken away in an ambulance and Gail Weathers gives her new, her misambitious local television reporter news report. The end.
Tyler, I have to very good very synopsis good. To him. I felt I had just I'm watched
seriously
it
like every time you talked, I was like, I see it.
I saw the scene. Tyler, I have a question then. So you months and months ago said, when you guys do Scream, I have to be there. Please let me do Scream with you guys. Please let me. And so that's why you are our first ever guest. And so why? What was the reason behind I have to be there for Scream?
It might be a product of the generation that I grew up in, but this was our slasher. This was our Halloween, our nightmare, our, you know, and since it came from the mind of Freddy Krueger as well, Wes Craven, it was kind of our thing. And so this is, and it's probably a product, like I said, a product of the generation. It's my favorite slasher franchise. And there's good, there's great, and there's bad in every one of these movies. I think every movie has good, great, and bad in everything, except for Paddington. Of course.
Oh yeah.
But yes, yeah. Which is all bad.
Well, and you're speaking of
unless it's Rotten Tomatoes, then it's all good, obviously.
Well, you're speaking of franchises. Yes. Yeah, there's franchises. Always going to be good and bad in a franchise.
And it was the voice on the phone and the costume that was created just for the movie and it was the idea that it gave me of this could happen. You know, I went to high school with people that I really think saw this movie and went, I could do that. There are people that I could kill. I mean, like, people that I tried to stay on their good list for that reason. Like,
are you saying you're that person?
No.
I lost you.
No. I went to school with people who I think would watch this movie and go, I could definitely kill some of my fellow students. And I was the guy who was like, I'm just going to be nice to everybody, no matter what their walk of life is, because I don't want to be on that list. That's
you're going to work at the video store. That's what you're going to do. You're going to be you're
Randy.
Guy. See, and that's the thing is, I immediately associated with Randy because in growing up, I was the movie guy with all the trivia. And you know, this is kind of like that part in Nightmare 3 when they become Dream Warriors. And they learn to control and so that was me. And I learned that I wouldn't through this franchise, I wouldn't survive the entire franchise. Spoiler alert. But it was probably a product of my generation, but this was my favorite. And I knew that you guys had to eventually talk about Scream. You have to talk
did
about
you it. See this movie when it came out?
I did not did get to go to the theaters released? Because I was
okay.
7 when it came out.
Oh.
Okay. Let me fix my walker here.
Yeah, I was only 30, no. I think.
Yeah.
Something
but like that. It was one of the first movies when it came out on VHS. For those kids who don't know what that is, it was this tape thing that we used to have to rewind after every use. And
every use.
Yeah, the sticker said so.
And it was one of the first ones that I got to talk my parents, my mom. She was the horror buff growing up with me, which now she can't even touch the stuff, which shocks me. I rented. Now, my first horror movie I ever saw as a kid, I was like 7 or 8, was The Exorcist, actually.
Oh.
And it just...
Good one to start with.
Yeah, it's a great one. Yeah. And that's where I fell in love with the genre. And this was one of the first movies I remember saying, Mom, can I rent this? And we watched it. And by the time the next one came out, I talked her into taking me to the actual theater and seeing it. And
it was pretty fast.
It was.
It came out the next year.
Pretty fast for sequels.
Yeah.
But obviously this most recent one wasn't that fast. It's like 20 years later, but,
well, and I have a confession to make. I have never seen any other Scream.
Really?
Oh,
this is the only Scream. I have not seen 2, 4, 5, 9, however many.
You should see 2.
I've not seen any of them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. So yeah, I have not. I did see this when it came out. I did think it was a brilliant script. I thought it was a great horror movie. Tim, I was going to query you because I was trying to think about in prepping for this. I can't think of a better horror opening. I think this has one of the best openings ever in history of a horror movie.
I do too. I think a lot of that, though, has to do with what Tyler was talking about as far as the movie of the generation. I mean, he mentioned Halloween, Nightmare on Elm Street, and Scream, and they all three came out almost 10 years apart in the middle of their respective decade. Mm-hmm. And because of the suspense of the slasher movies and the history that we already had of them, you could start in medias res in the middle of things, in the beginning of this movie, and know exactly what to watch out for and to be afraid of.
But I mean, Halloween may be second. Halloween has a great opening. That whole, the young Michael whole opening thing works for me. And that's a great opening bit. Nightmare doesn't. Nightmare opens with the nightmare sequence in the boiler with the lamb and all that crap and stuff. You know, this one just hooks. And I think it is the voice. It is Drew Barrymore's performance, which is awesome. Amazing. It is, it is just the structure of this. The fact that the phone comes and goes and comes and goes is like gives us those little breaths. And then suddenly it's like, oh my God, it's back. And it just builds each time.
It's like the,
and I think it's a brilliant
opening. The phone is like the fin in Jaws, is what I say.
Yeah. When you see it or when you hear it, it's like the
sound of it.
Yeah.
Something's coming.
Yeah. This was in the midst of, as I said, my generation growing up, where they created the thing that you could do on your landline, star whatever, to hide your number. When I got to middle school, was doing that to people and trying to emulate this voice. They were trying to,
hello, Sydney.
Surprise, you know. And so that really drove, I was like, this is grasping my generation and it's scaring the shit out of me when it happens to me because I just know that he's out there behind the pool watching every move I make.
Well, Tim, before you share your story of first experience, I have to share a companion piece, ironically, to mine. Barbara will not watch horror movies, period. She actually will not listen to horror
movies. We have similar spouses.
Yes. The reason is this movie. She actually went to see this movie with one of her best friends at the time when it came out. They were in Morristown. They were at a small theater. They actually stayed afterwards because she said that movie freaked her out so bad. Then they realized that only the two of them are in the theater. And so they start to leave and they're still talking about the movie. And it's at the very end of a multiplex, all the way down this dark hall, I mean, this hallway and everything else. And she's talking about, I just don't believe it. I just don't think friends would do that and kill their friends. And her friend, Eric, pulled out a knife that he had and said, you mean like this? And opened it up and all the lights went out. And they had had a power failure, and he was just doing it as a joke, but it traumatized her for the rest of her life that she was in the end of this corridor, nobody else around, and her best friend just pulled a knife on her, and it went black.
Wow.
So she always shares that story and says, I will never watch a horror movie again. No.
I think it's how often do power failures happen in movie theaters? Because you and I were in one in Aliens in 1986. And I was going to say, that does not happen that often.
No. So it was a very unique experience for her, but I wanted to share it because when I was watching this again, I was remembering her just saying, why would friends do – I don't think friends would really kill each other like that. You mean like this?
You mean
blackout.
He should have done the voice. You mean like this, Sydney?
Sydney.
What about you, Tim? Did you see it?
Before I talk about that, I did want to say I wasn't trying to compare the openings of Halloween and Nightmare on Elm Street to this movie. I'm talking about the history. I mean, you could also lump in other movies like When a Stranger Calls. We had it in our genetic upbringing to know, you know, something could be around the corner or, uh-oh, if the phone rings, that kind of thing. So what I'm saying is when he started so starkly, we didn't have to really catch up. We were already in the moment. Mm-hmm. So that's what I was trying to say. I did see this movie in a theater. I believe I saw it with my friend Dan Hester, who I used to work with at H&R Block back in the 90s. He was a big fan, mm-hmm. and I think we went and saw this and maybe a sequel or two together. So,
well, it was a to me, from a production angle, it's a perfect storm of a movie. Mm-hmm. You have Wes Craven, who knows his craft probably better than anybody other than maybe Carpenter, and Carpenter actually lost it near the end.
Well, both their problems were scripts, really. They're great directors with terrible scripts sometimes. Yeah.
But this one had a great, great script. I cannot believe when I researched that Williamson wrote it like really quickly. Because it is so meta-referential, it is so timely for its time, but also still works now. Even rewatching it this week, it was like, okay, all those, like you said, Tyler, all those references are things I would say. You know, this is just like what happened in such and such. And, you know, oh my God, this is the part where the killer comes back to life. You know, it was so well written. And performances. I mean, except for a few instances where I think the boys are overplaying it, I think it works really well. I'm curious, Tyler, what's your, like, do you have favorite scenes? Are there scenes that you like most that stand out in this
movie? That stand out, the scene that always made me go, ooh, is they've arrested Billy. And he's in for the night, and she's staying at Tatum's house, and the killer still calls, which immediately throws your suspicion off of the boyfriend, which was brilliant on their part as scriptwriters and as the killers, you know, like the thought that the other killer, Stu, was like, I should call her now to throw her scent off of Billy because we need this to go a little further. We want this to go further. Mm-hmm. There's a finale we're planning. That scene always comes to mind because it really accents the fact that they're smarter than you think. Because Stu really plays dumb really well. And, you know, I think it's one of the more... I think Lillard's one of the more underappreciated actors in all the stuff he does. And his genres that he's crossed and the characters he's played and... He does overplay at the end where I'm like, I probably would have pulled it back a little bit personally, you know, when he's doing like that. It's a scream, baby, you know.
I'll be right back.
I think you killed me here, man.
I saw a review of the movie and it was a one sentence review and said, wow, Shaggy really lost it after Scooby passed over. Huh?
That's great. I forgot that he even did that.
Yeah.
But
that scene stuck out the most to me because it changed my mind as the viewer immediately. I was like, oh, wow.
Well, it's a great red herring. It is a great red herring and a great, like, a half twist for from a story screenplay point of view.
And you get little character. You get a little more of Sydney, like, breaking down a little bit. How much protective Tatum is of her, how rude Tatum is to her older brother, Dewey. Dewey comes out in his boxers and a white shirt with a gun in his hand, and he, like, you know, to save the day,
he's just like,
hello, on the phone, and it just so much character, just little character things sprinkled throughout, too.
Yeah. I think one, definitely the scene for me is the kitchen scene, because... It is so dark. And
are you talking about when they reveal themselves?
Oh, yeah. With the whole kitchen stabbing and telling the story and your mom was a slut and all the, it just, the movie, as any kind of levity you might have had before, even with their over the top performances, is gone. Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, this is a dark, sick, twisted place. These guys are willing to stab each other. To the point where he goes, I'm losing a lot of blood, man.
Feeling kind of woozy.
You know?
I think I'm actually feeling kind of woozy.
Yeah, that's it, it's dark. It's a dark.
And I would say the other one is the video store when Randy is talking to Stu about.
That's a good scene. You mean you like that?
I think it adds that whole who Randy is, and a lot of my scenes include Randy because I immediately identified as Randy. Mm-hmm. But any scenes that sprinkle in a little more character stuff in any movie is what I'm always a fan of, because I guess growing up from theater and stuff.
We are too. We are definitely too. It's all about the characters in the story, much more so than how it's shot, where it's shot, what effects you have, what action sequence you just threw in, JJ, just for no damn reason. But yeah, I'm so into, and I think it says a lot about this cast. Mm-hmm. I mean, Neve Campbell was a great catch for this movie.
She was.
I think she's really strong in this movie. And I think, you know, Rose McGowan is great. The boys, like I said, are a little bit overplayed. But even Henry Winkler isn't bad, except for the big "I'm your principal and I'm a douche" scene. He's actually pretty good in the rest.
And the Fonz thing.
And the Fonz. I'm going to put this mask on.
Yeah.
No. Tim, what about you? Favorite scene?
Definitely the first scene. I think the opening of this movie is one of the strongest things about it. And it is obviously because of Drew Barrymore. She's just phenomenal in it. And he had originally, and I'll get to this in casting, intended for her to play the lead. And she's the one that suggested she be the first girl because she wanted to turn it into a psycho thing. So that was – you can basically – I mean, Wes Craven's dead, so we can't ask him, but she takes credit for that.
Well, it's such a great – I mean, she plays it so well with this kind of pseudo-flirty, kind of sexy, kind of neat, I don't have a boyfriend, which is so standard of that. Even now, it would be like through text or Twitter or TikTok or whatever, you know. But then suddenly turning the terror on and making it believable enough, plus the fact that, hey, this movie has some great blood. The blood in this movie – definitely not Italian horror blood. This is good blood.
Yeah. And everything about that scene, I mean, it's so expertly crafted and edited by, I'm assuming, Craven. I mean, he obviously filmed it. I'm not sure if he edited it. But, like, when she mentions Halloween, she's, like, pulling that knife out of the knife fly. It's like everything is perfectly timed. I mean, it took them 5 days to film that scene. That's all Drew Barrymore was there.
Wow.
And I mean, it is like blocked out like a play. Everything is on point. So that would be my favorite scene. The scene I relate to.
And that's an actual location, right? That's a real house. They didn't build a house. That's a real house.
I didn't
house.
Look that up, but I'm assuming. It looks
I think in my research, I'll have to look at my notes, but I think in my research, both the houses they actually found in Northern Carolina and wrote the shot structure around the house. Yeah. You know, the thing for the guy was in the first scene, it had to have more glass than you would ever have in any house. So, you know, well,
unless
openings
you watch Ozark.
And glass.
Yeah.
I don't watch
season one.
That's a house of windows. Yeah.
Ah, okay.
And I think that was one thing that Wes wanted was as much practicality as possible, which I'm also a
fan even of. Down to like the closet door and the door that don't meet. So you make that a gag
So
what else, Tim?
There's several scenes that one in particular, the one I relate to the most, even though I am Randy too and would know all that stuff and what not to do, I am totally Tatum, man. My ass would be going through that doggy door. I can guarantee it. So that scene.
I don't know if you would look as good.
I don't know that that door would lift me and break me, but I would definitely be stuck in it for sure.
I want to know why Tatum only has two outfits in the whole movie other than her pajamas, because she wears the same in the scene in school. She's wearing the same scene that all day.
Oh, she likes that skirt.
I guess she didn't. Yeah, she didn't change to go to the party. Seems like she would. But anyway,
that was probably. Lack of
a rose
of
thing.
It might have been a rose thing. She's like, I don't want a lot of changes. Okay, could have been the costume department going. She doesn't need many costumes. She really doesn't.
Nah.
Do you have a favorite scene, David, that we're not touching on?
No, I mean, those two, I agree with all of those. I think, like I said, the kitchen was probably my most graphic. The first scene is really good. The first red herring, which is the phone call setup, which I, again, I think is a Billy thing. I don't think Stu is that smart. I think he's smart enough to agree with Billy and maybe throw some ideas at him. But I think Billy's the psychopath, the true psychopath.
Well, they even say, like, you know, who was your one phone call? And he says, my dad. But when I called, he didn't answer. He easily could have called Stu and said, you're going to have to throw attention off of me.
Yeah.
Call.
Yeah, which I think is the real thing. He really called Stu and said, hey, call her right now so I can get out, you know, sort of thing. And I think that's another thing. You know, I guess it's not a favorite scene, but I do like the crafting of this plot. I kept looking back at it this time saying, okay, what if I was Billy and Stu? What did I plan and what did I improvise? And a lot of times in horror movies, you find the mistakes really easy. The holes are there. And it's like, no, there's no freaking way. There's only a few of those.
Yeah,
in
the bathroom scene is one.
Yeah, the bathroom scene, the principle in general is an issue. I mean, I know you can finally kind of justify at the end and say, oh, okay, they needed something to get all the kids to go to the school. Yeah. So we're putting it, but you took the time to put the principal on the freaking goalpost. One of you.
Yeah.
And you some skinny boys. I don't know if you're going to be able to do that, but also the other one, like, you know, Tatum and, Nev, Tatum and what's her name?
Sydney.
Prescott? Oh, Sydney.
Sydney. Are at the house and you see the killer in the woods.
Yes.
Yet he's supposed to be at the school.
Yes.
Yet then he's going to the other house. You know, so there's that, you know, but I, you know, I love some of the, like you said, the character bits he throws in. I love the fact that this is like one of my keys is this is the Indiana Jones of serial killers because he gets the crap kicked out of him all the time.
Mm-hmm.
He gets bottles in the head and nuts and doors banged in his face.
He falls a lot too.
Falls.
I'd have been done after one bottle. I'd have been like, well, I mean, think this is for me.
Again, that outfit would not be easy to move around.
No,
like wearing a blanket.
It's so. Yeah, and it's so long and tattered at the bottom. You'd be tripping over it and all kinds of stuff.
Back to what you were saying about the construction or the script, the story. One of my big keys, and I'll just go ahead and reveal it because it has to do with what you're saying, is Kevin Williams' brilliance. And most people don't get this, not the average audience. They wouldn't think about this. But he not only married the slasher film – he married the Agatha Christie whodunit.
Mm-hmm.
You're always going, oh, it's him. No, it's him. It could be her. You know, you're constantly guessing who it is, which is another really popular franchise that's kind of gone the way of things past. Mm-hmm. I mean, Kenneth Branagh's trying to bring it back, doing some Agatha Christie movies. But, I mean, not many mystery whodunit type things are out there anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Knives Out is trying to
do.
It became really popular, you know, and it, even though I don't like it, I don't see why people do, but they do. And they're making a sequel. I have two keys from Agatha. I have, and then there were none because the guy that you thought was dead turns out to be alive, which is an old trope that lots of horror movies have used and murder mysteries have used, of course, you know, fake your own death and come back, you know, but also the whole murder on the Nile, which is everybody did it. You know, in this one, it's only two of them, but basically you got more than one killer. Everybody did it. I love that. And I think, Tim, to your point, that's what I started seeing this time. I started seeing, okay, so, you know, they're setting up. This scene kind of throws suspicion towards Dewey. Okay, this scene kind of throws suspicion toward the principal even. Okay, this scene kind of throws suspicion toward this guy. And I agree with that. I think that's a clever screenwriting.
Right. So you've got things for people to latch onto other than the scares.
And that's one thing Madison said when I was taking her through it before the new one came out, because we knew we wanted to go to the theater to see it, is she said, I don't trust anyone. Especially after the first one, I meet characters and she's the type that, like, I showed her The Princess Bride And you know, in that first 5 minutes of The Princess Bride where Wesley goes away and it said he never came back, he died. She goes, right. Is he dead, dead? Like, I'm like, we're 5 minutes in. I'm not telling you.
Don't question
me. Watch it how I watched it. don't look up spoilers. She says, I don't trust anyone in these movies. Even when we got to two, you're like, she's like, I don't even trust the good guy from the first one. I don't even trust Randy. Like, she was like, I don't trust anyone. Anybody could have done it.
I think that's
what Wes wanted to do. You know, and he did it well.
It turns out in Scream 4, Dewey masterminded all
of it,
all the murders from the very beginning, just to get back at his sister. She's the one he wanted to kill first.
I don't remember 3 or 4, but I do remember 2, because Cotton comes back into play. Leaf Schreiber is the character.
Well, that's a perfect, go.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen it yet, but that's where I would go with it. I would go with Gail, Cotton, try to get him out.
Funny should say that. Did you know that when this was a 5-page treatment, I mean, when this was a treatment that he was shopping around, he did a 5-page treatment of the sequel and tacked it on to the end of the script?
No, really?
Did. So this sequel was already in the works before the first one was even produced.
Wow. Which is probably why it was so fast. Yeah. So Tyler, you've seen the new one. So are both of you?
I have not seen the new one.
Okay. Is the new one a reboot, a continuation, a requel?
It's a new term that I would say the first requel that really gained traction and the big screen, not successfully, was Independence Day 2. Was a requel. You bring back originals, but push forward these new characters. Kevin Smith just did it with Jay and Silent Bob, the reboot. That's what Ghostbusters.
With what?
Jay and Silent Bob, the reboot.
Oh, Jay and Silent Bob.
The reboot is what he calls it. And it's like a requel. It's bring back Jay and Silent Bob, their old gags, but a new cast for a new generation, a new Jay and Silent Bob. Then Jason Reitman did it with the Ghostbusters movie.
That's what I was thinking. Ghostbusters did the same thing.
Yeah. So it's, you bring back your legacies like Dewey and Gale and Sydney, but there's a whole generation of new high schoolers in Woodsboro. And most of them are, and this is in the trailer, so it's not are linked to past characters, whether related to them or whatnot. So, it pushes forward the possibility of, which it's already, Scream 6 is happening. It comes out next year. And the reason they called this Scream, again, instead of Scream 5, is it is a requel. It's to push forward this new franchise, this new generation, but they used legacy characters to do it. So it's
then
a requel.
Then why call the next one Scream 6?
I don't know. I don't know. I don't know why they called this one Scream if there's a sequel. I was like, this seemed
fine. But Halloween did it too, didn't they?
Yeah, they did.
Well, and that's what I was just going to say. Halloween and Texas Chainsaw both have the same kind of thing. The new Texas Chainsaw has Leatherface and also has, what's her name, the girl from the original.
The character, not the actress.
Yet it's a bunch of young new kids who can carry on ever. And the new Halloween, Tim's, you've seen the new Halloweens. They've got Jamie. And I mean,
I actually liked the first one. The second one was totally terrible.
Most recent one was bad.
Yeah.
It's
money.
But the good thing about this was this didn't feel in the production notes I was reading about and stuff like that. This doesn't feel like it was a money grab. This felt like you had some really, really dedicated people who wanted to do
it. Oh, I totally agree.
Mm-hmm.
And they weren't even thinking about the sequel until near the end of it when obviously Kevin Williamson was, but I don't think Wes was.
No, Wes wasn't even going to do it. Wes was trying to distance himself from horror at the time. There were a couple of things that made him decide to. One was the script. And 2 was Drew Barrymore signing on. And 3 was some kid had taunted him at a convention and said, why don't you make scary movies anymore? Your movies aren't any good anymore. They're not like Nightmare on Elm Street. I'm serious. I've got this in my notes. And he decided he could go back and do it better. And he did. But it, yeah. like I said, it took a really good script. That's the problem. John Carpenter and Wes Craven are both excellent directors. But when they write their own stuff, it's not that great all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, look at Nightmare on Elm Street. Yep. That ending's terrible. Of course, I think that was more the studio. But
see, George Lucas. George Lucas is neither, but he's a great producer. Mm-hmm. He should be an executive producer creator, not a... writer or
definitely not a writer.
Really. Definitely not a writer.
Especially dialogue.
Thank you. Oh, Annie.
I've got a little bit more of background stuff. I mentioned the script, having the 5-page treatment of the sequel on it. This script, there was a huge bidding war for this. Do you remember this?
I remember in my notes it said that Williamson, actually his agent pitched it out there and they thought they would have a few weeks to think about it or whatever. And by the next morning it was a bid.
It was. And it, what I have it in my was notes. In between Paramount Pictures, Universal, and Morgan Creek. The two final bidders were Oliver Stone and the Weinsteins. And we all know about Mr. Weinstein. But anyway, Paramount ended up snagging Miramax, and that's what sealed the deal, because Paramount was already bidding for it. So Paramount's got it for the Weinsteins. So okay. It was a hot
was script. Wes attached from the was Wes attached from the beginning?
I don't think so. Like I said, let me go down here to I've got that he initially turned it down because he was developing a remake of The Haunting, which I wonder if it's the one that Jan de Bont went on to do a few years later. He signed on after Drew agreed to do it. So, and I said, and a young boy accused him of going soft, that he had more guts making movies like Last House on the Left. Can you imagine a little kid coming up
right,
to him?
You're right.
That's like when I did that to Stephen King. Yeah, Salem's Lot, the TV movie sucked. Anyway.
I mean, I do think from a plot perspective, you know, my normal overanalyze everything and get picky, but the it does fall apart in the last act. There are some weirdness there that doesn't.
Well, hurt. A lot of it, you know, just like, seems so implausible. You know, everyone being somewhere at a certain time.
That's what
time.
I mean. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Everybody has to be in certain places at certain times. Gail wrecks this van in a great stunt, but then later on he goes, "I thought she was dead. How would he even know?" And nobody even went near.
No, she was. Actually, someone was. The body was on top of it.
Yeah,
Kevin's body Kenny's body.
Stu allegedly checked on her because he goes, "I thought you said she was dead," and he goes, "She looked dead." So somewhere between him. Disappearing when Tatum died to coming back, he checked on Gail's body, I guess, you know.
Yeah, I mean, all that last 15 details. Is just like really contrived. And
well, and she, I mean,
even before that, though, you've got we steal the principal and we put him on the goalpost. Then for some reason, I want to take Kenny, even though I've killed him. I want to put
they
him
killed
on
Kenny, the you bastards,
you bastards. So I didn't get some of that. I mean, Billy has the gun at one point. Nev comes out dressed as like evil Scream Mary Poppins and stabs him with her umbrella. And he drops the gun. But then a few minutes later, Gail shows up with the gun.
A gun.
And I didn't take the safety off this time. Da, da, da. You know, and I'm like, how did she get it was in the middle of the hall where they're laying. How did she get it at the door?
Why didn't she get Dewey's in the first place?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, she's laying right beside him.
She appears dead more than once in this movie.
Yes.
And how can Stu be so weak that he's literally saying, "I think I'm dying here, man," and then have two more fight scenes?
Because they want to drop a television set on his head.
Yeah.
Which is very Wes Craven. He did that in Nightmare 3 as well.
There you go. Yes.
Welcome to Drag Time.
But the thing is, the plotting up until that point had gotten to a point, and the character development, everything was so good that you really didn't care. You're in that last act chase. Mm-hmm. You're just letting it happen. And even though it bothered me, those two guys over your shoulder are freaking creepy. Tyler's, again, acting stuff, if they had pulled down like 10%, it would have been perfect. But they are so over the top. I mean, Billy is so, I'm going to stare and be menacing, and my little hair is going to hang here in a pseudo emo-y kind of thing. And it's just going to be, your mother was a slut. And if he had just pulled back just a hair, and if Lillard had come down.
If they had been more like, speaking to
Leopold and Lope.
Speaking to David Horton here, more rote about it.
Yeah.
From Wait Until Dark, pull it back a little, pull it back that much, and keep it in that subtle, eerie, controlled, calculated. Calculated is far more scary for me than theatrical.
I will say that the phone call is a focal point in the movie because I suspected Billy, just like Sidney did at the beginning. And without that phone call, I probably would have suspected him all the way through. So the phone call was a great idea to throw suspicion away from him. So I agree with that.
Yeah.
So in Scream 4, they all did it. Sydney. Sydney, she kills herself.
I mean, I don't know how much you want to have spoiled for you.
I don't care.
So you mentioned Cotton Weary coming back for 2. He actually comes back for 3.
Right.
He's the first death in 3 to kind of tie it all together.
In 2,
they're at college, and it's the...
There's a theatrical production going on.
There is a theatrical production, and Sydney is the star of the production.
Mm-hmm.
And the killers are one of her friends, Mickey, and Billy's mother, who's getting revenge.
Right, I forgot about that.
Mrs. Salt is getting revenged on Sydney. And in 3, it's her illegitimate brother, because as this story that's building, because
her mother was
exactly that's the story they're building, is that she had an illegitimate son. And in 4, it's her freaking cousin who's just tired of Sydney's spotlight and wants her own. She's like, it's my time to shine. I'm the new final girl, it's my turn. I don't want to spoil 5, the newest one, too much, because I think it's definitely worth
seeing. Spoil one thing and people might not want to listen.
That's true.
Turn off your mics right now.
I'm telling you, take your earphones out. Skeet Ulrich is in the cast.
Yes, he is.
On IMDb.
Yes.
And he got a fucking bullet in the forehead in this movie, so I don't buy it.
Yes.
That was all fake. He and Gail Withers, or he and Sydney, were in it together. No, I don't know.
Do you want to know?
Yeah, sure.
The main girl in this is his daughter, and he has basically been haunting her. That voice in the back of her head. Once she realizes, no, it's like he's there in the mirror looking at her, saying like, "You're tougher than this." You know.
So they turned it to paranormal.
Yeah. Not paranormal. It's more of like once she knows who she is, everybody who lives in Woodsboro knows what happened. I mean, heck. Even in a more meta way, they started making movies within the movie Stab. They started making the movie Stab in Scream.
Right. Right.
Yeah. So everybody who lives in Woodsboro knows what happened, knows where it began, knows that Billy and Stu started this whole thing. And when she finds out, she knew the whole time that she was Billy's daughter. It's kind of like this voice, you know, like, you shouldn't trust anyone. You should kill them all. Just kill them all. We have it in us. Kill him.
I don't know if I would like Skeet Ulrich's voice in my head. I don't think I would. No.
It's done.
It'd be like a decently. Johnny Depp.
It's decently. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Bargain basement Johnny Depp.
Bargain basement Johnny Depp. There you go.
Oh, so this is who I get. I don't get Johnny. I get Skeet. Great. Awesome. I guess I couldn't afford Johnny.
Well, Johnny's still in the courtroom, you know, for a little
while. I tell you something that I wish I would have seen, and David and I actually did something similar with Death Trap. I guess in the 90s, it was still just way too taboo to have gay couples. But I think Stu and Billy should have been a gay couple.
Absolutely.
That would have explained a hell of a lot, especially if you look at that picture of them behind me.
Yeah.
I just think it would have made a lot more sense.
And there were times where I felt that from Lillard's performance. I felt like, is he in love with Stu?
Oh,
I think Stu's in love with...
And it also would have It also would have negated the whole, oh, I just had sex with you sort of thing, because he really just did that to defile
her. Yeah, right. Because he did it to her mom.
She's nothing to him.
And right. to right. And make sure.
Been, and he might not have been that sorry that he wasn't having yeah. sex with her, too.
And yeah. he had to make sure
yeah.
that she broke the rules. Because so far, yeah, she oh, hadn't yeah. broken any rules. She never said, I'll be right back. Right. She never really looked for the noise, and she hadn't had sex. So she had to break. He did follow the rules. You have to say that about him. He followed the rules to a T. He had to have sex yeah. with her because only then could she be killed.
And
she can't be the final girl yeah, if she has sex.
I would love to talk to Kevin Williams about this, because he is gay. And I have a feeling that was the script and that they yeah. made him change it.
I would agree.
Well, we know how studios
and I think that,
can put their hands on things and ruin them.
David.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's true. That would have in 96 that
so,
would have been
So let me ask this one because it was he said no sex, no drugs or drinking because that's our alcohol you can't say I'll
be right
never
back.
Never say I'll be right back. And then the other rule was that at the end the killer
come
will
back. Yeah.
jump up
for a final
come
scare.
Back. Are there more rules in like 2, 3, and 4?
Another spoiler is Randy doesn't make it past 2. He dies in 2.
Oh,
brutally.
But Randy was the rule
exactly.
man.
And he even says he does come back for an homage in 3. He left a tape, kind of like a postmortem tape.
Oh,
and
that's funny. I remember
his sister
that.
Brings it to them, which in 3, Patrick Dempsey is a character in 3. Yeah, he's a cop.
Okay.
He leaves a tape that his sister brings to them when she hears what Sid's going through in Hollywood. 3 takes place in Hollywood. A lot of movie sets, a lot of meta director talk and stuff like that. Lance Herskin's actually in
okay.
it. As okay. a producer, as a movie studio head. And so is Carrie's in it. Our princess, our dear princess, rest in peace, Leia, is in it.
Yes.
And she actually, there's a joke where Parker Posey's character looks at her and goes, "Are you?" And she goes, "No, I was passed up. I was passed up for Leia because I wouldn't sleep with the director, but you know, she sleeps with George and she gets the part." You know, they make that whole joke. I think you'd like
That's
3
awesome.
For the laughs. It's not that good, but the Hollywood meta laughs are worth the watch. And it's pretty star studded, actually. So Randy leaves a postmortem tape saying like, if you're watching this, I died. If it's still going on, then you're not, you know, I didn't survive the things that happened at college is basically what he says. If you're watching this, I didn't survive this second run in with Ghostface.
Right.
So if it's happening again, you are in the heat of a trilogy and there are different rules in a trilogy. Anybody can be guilty. Even
oh,
you
nice.
Sid, even you can be guilty in this one. So it's really cool.
I love
they
that.
Did do that. It was really
cool.
good.
Yeah, they play up the meta stuff more and more as the franchise goes, which is a good addition, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It is.
Hey, so Ghostface, the mask, that was created for this, correct?
Yes.
They didn't, you know, it's like we know the story. Halloween was a Shatner mask that they modified. You know, Jason is just a hockey mask brutalized. Mm-hmm. So this was, they literally made that or designed
it. Yeah, this was designed for the movie. It was not a costume prior. But now, God, even if you haven't seen Scream, everybody's been Ghostface for Halloween at least once, you know, because it's terrifying.
Yeah.
I mean, it's associated with a great slasher franchise that scared people of a generation. So, and that's why, and now they've even brutalized it as making it plastic with blood coming down it. You know, those masks.
Yeah.
The pump.
Right.
Yeah.
Although it's a totally, as Tim has said several times, it's a totally impractical costume.
I've got what it was inspired by here. It was mainly inspired by the painting by Edward Munch, Scream. It was also based on characters from the cover of Pink Floyd's The Wall soundtrack, that one with the big mouth screaming. And then it was also some ghostly characters that appeared in a 1930s Betty Boop cartoon. That's a lot, man.
Well, it's probably the eyes, too. Those eyes have a pseudo-comic, almost comic kind of sadness to them.
Yeah, it does kind of show somewhat of a the tragedy mask, comedy and tragedy.
They said it's horrible, it's sorry, and it's frantic.
And it's dead. It's like anybody could be behind that mask, and there's no emotion whatsoever. It's just dead. It's just because killer always does this head tilt to the innocent victim, and there's no emotion. It's kind of like Jaws' eyes, what Quint says about the eyes. They're black as doll's eyes. You know, there's no remorse. There's no emotion.
Wow.
That's
a key. That's a pretty cool key. There's really only one moment in this, and that's Tatum's death, where we actually get an aftermath with the killer. And that's just that slow, you know, going in the door as he's looking at her body hanging there. Other than that, in this, you know, like the Halloween one where Jason, you know, that great moment where Michael's just standing there and he's looking at the guy. He's just pinned to the wall and he's just doing the dog head thing. It's great. Which is actually the scene they show in this movie.
They're watching Halloween.
But yeah. But the killer in this is so frantic. Mm. You never get that opportunity. He either disappears totally or he's running somewhere else, chasing somebody.
His cardio is through the roof. Because to get from one place to another, I bet one of them's like,
they can do the,
I got to do all this work.
They can do the relay. Your turn, man. Take the knife and go. I got
to
rest.
You guys like me and wondering and watching to see if one of them was much taller than the other.
Yes.
Yes.
Because, I mean, you can't watch this a second time without remembering it.
Yeah.
I couldn't. I mean, I would always be looking. I knew they were the killers going in, even though it had been 20 years since I'd seen it or whatever. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and that's why you look at that scene in the when they're all sitting around the fountain and the looks that they share with each other. I was going, okay, that's a rewatch moment because you wouldn't think about it the first time you saw it. But when he's saying, man, it's because da-da-da, he got sliced and diced, and he's looking at him like, yeah, he did. Shut the hell up, you know, kind of thing. Right.
You're going to give this away before the movie's over. Stop.
Right. It's only the fourth scene, dude. Shut up.
I can go into casting if you guys are ready.
Please do.
I don't really have anything on Drew Barrymore except what I already told you, that she decided she wanted to be the first one killed instead of the main character because she thought it would give it a psycho twist, which is a very big key. You know, kill the lead movie star first. And it was shot in 5 days. Nev Campbell was not who Kevin Williams imagined in the role. He imagined his favorite Molly Ringwald in the role, but she turned it down, saying she didn't feel like playing a 27-year-old high school student. Thought that was quite funny, actually.
Yeah. She had already played high school students, so.
Yeah. She had been playing them a long time before. That would have been weird, because Breakfast Club was in the mid-'80s, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Wes Craven had seen Nev Campbell in Party of Five and asked her to audition. Ironically, Tori Spelling was considered for the role. And as you know, she ends up playing, plays a part in Stab.
She plays Sydney in Stab.
Okay, that's it.
Well, there's a line in this where she says
if they make a movie.
If they made a movie of this.
Exactly. And that's what they do in the sequel. Yeah.
Which is brilliant.
Oh, yeah. Again, meta reference.
Oh, yeah. Actually, I just had, sorry, I was looking at the line you just said where she says, with my luck, it would be Tori Spelling.
Right.
Melissa Joan Hart, Brittany Murphy, rest in peace, Alicia Witt, Melanie Linsky, and Melinda Clark all auditioned for the role. But a rather major star now, but not at the time, turned it down, and that was Reese Witherspoon. Wow. Mm. So that would have been interesting.
That would have been interesting. Yeah, but she would have been too Drew-ish. They would have had to have done something, I think. Brittany Murphy, though, that would have been a unique.
I love her. I hated that she
I thought
died.
She was great. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, she was great.
Skeet Ulrich played Billy, obviously. Billy Loomis. There's another key right there from Halloween. Yep.
Halloween.
Joaquin Phoenix apparently turned that role down. I didn't even realize he was that big then. But I guess that was shortly after. That was very shortly after River Phoenix died, because he died in like 94. Yeah.
Might have been why he turned it down.
I don't know. That would have been a good role for him. David Arquette and Matthew Lillard, who are both in the film as Stu and Dewey, were considered for the role of Billy before he was eventually cast as Dewey and Stu was cast as, Matthew was cast as Stu. Here's your one. Leonardo DiCaprio and Holly Marie Combs screen tested together for Billy and Sydney. I want to see that screen test.
I'd love to see that too. Holly Marie Combs is a good suggestion. That's not bad for a Nev.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would work. Didn't Skeet go on to have like a checkered career? Didn't he do like.
He didn't do a lot.
Yeah.
Because I looked. I was like, I don't know any of this stuff. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I seem to remember he went on and kind of went into the adult entertainment industry for a while.
I don't remember that, but just giving a quick glance at IMDb, he was before Scream, he was in The Craft, so he wanted to do that because he and Nev Campbell had worked together before. Mm-hmm. But he was in a movie called Into the West and a movie called Armored. I don't know anything about them. But maybe he did do a little porn. Who knows?
haven't we all? I mean, come on. You know,
back I was young and needed the money.
Anyway, go ahead. Yeah, he was young and needed
Gail
money.
Gail Weathers, played by Courtney Cox. The reason she pursued this role was because of her not wanting to be typecast as the nice girl from Friends. She wanted to play a bitch.
Good.
And Wes Craven thought it was a great idea. However, Elizabeth Berkley auditioned for the role and was immediately turned down because of the backlash she had received from Showgirls the year prior.
God, no. God, no. She would have made an interesting Tatum, though.
Brooke Shields was nearly cast as Gail Weathers. I could see that in a heartbeat.
Yeah.
However, that was after Janine Garofalo turned the role down. So at some point, Janine Garofalo was cast as the
Wow.
Wow. Okay.
I love Janine Garofalo.
Yeah.
Yeah. She would have.
But
been
I don't know. Yeah. I think see that. I don't know if she would have fit the part though. I think she needs to be really, really glamorous, and Janine's not really a glamorous actress. Brooke Shields
Agreed.
Would have been. Mm-hmm. Let's see. I have Kenny was W. Earl Brown. I don't know much about him except that he went on to be in Deadwood, which was a good series I liked on HBO. Uh-huh. Rose McGowan recounts the filming of this movie as her favorite experience in Hollywood. Rebecca Gayhart auditioned for the role of Tatum, but she had scheduling conflicts with something called Somebody Is Waiting, which prevented her from landing the role, so she turned up in Scream 2 playing a sorority sister. Cast is very incestuous, if you haven't guessed that already.
Actually, yeah, it is throughout the sequels. It is. People who didn't get to do 1 or 2 show up randomly in 3 or 4.
Yeah. In a later interview, David Arquette, in revealing that he was once considered for the Billy part, said he really wanted the Dewey part because he felt it was more of a hunky leading man role. That's great.
Yeah.
I mean, I do say, to his credit, he walks the line very thinly.
He's very lovable in this
very
movie.
Well.
Mm-hmm. I think he's great.
Yeah, because he could easily have turned this into, go for the comedy, go for the shtick all the time, and he doesn't. He always adds a realistic kind of interpret to it, which works. Could have been a cartoony character.
Even in the scene where the chief is smoking, and he's eating an ice cream cone.
With the ice cream
but he
cone,
treats it like a cigarette.
Yeah.
The obligatory stomp on the cigarette button.
Mm-hmm. Also, he totally credits Wes Craven for his marriage to Courtney Cox. He said Wes encouraged that the whole time. Yeah.
Well, all four of the women in this are hot. I mean, this is an attractive cast. Very attractive cast.
You mentioned Sheriff Burke. He is played by Joseph Whipp, who was also a cop in Nightmare on Elm Street. Imagine that.
Yep.
He said that his backstory was that he got upset by the events in Nightmare on Elm Street and moved to a small town in Northern California.
And then was suddenly in Haddonville or wherever.
Matthew Lilliard, who played Stewart, that role was originally Freddie Prinze Jr. originally auditioned for it. He went on to be in I Know What You Did Last Summer, which was also written by Kevin Williamson. Mm-hmm. So we got a little bit of incest there. Jamie Kennedy, who played Randy, got the role because he made Wes laugh all the time. Wes thought he was just the funniest guy in the world.
That's how I get my
What happened to his career? Where is he?
He got stolen by Seth Green. I said he got stolen by Seth Green.
His career? Yeah.
Didn't it? I mean, isn't Seth Green and him pretty much the same person?
Pretty much, yeah.
I don't know. I really don't know. Yeah, I didn't look to see what else he had done, but I'm sure he's probably still around. Other people that auditioned for Randy, Brecken Meyer and Jason Lee. I think Jason Lee would have been fun in that part.
Especially like the whole Weinstein thing, because he was in all the Jay and Silent Bob movies. He's worked with the company.
He was Earl.
Yeah, he is Earl.
And then
Jason Lee.
Apparently the three of them, including Kennedy, were in the final callback for auditions. Kennedy beat them out.
Wow.
So, and then there's a lot of people are uncredited. Liv Schreiber, does he have like a brief scene, like in being incarcerated, maybe?
Yeah, it's
We only get to see him in the police car
because he's kind of like a flashback. Linda Blair does a cameo, everybody, her head does not spin around. Wes Craven has a great cameo that's a little forced with a Freddy Krueger sweater as a janitor in the hall.
A little forced?
A little on the nose.
A little forced. The only thing he doesn't have is the glove. I mean, come on.
I mean, literally, he's the janitor named Fred wearing a Freddy Krueger attire.
And he calls Henry Winkler a bitch or something. Yeah. I can't remember what he calls him. Yeah. And then, of course, Henry Winkler plays the principal. Hembree. And that is all I have on casting. As far as awards, this movie was not what you would call a runaway Oscar type movie, like the one we did last week was. However, our friends at the Academy of Science Fiction, Fantasy, and Horror Films gave it a Saturn Award for Best Horror Film of the Year and Best Actress, Neve Campbell, and Best Writer, Kevin Williamson. It was also nominated for Supporting Actor with Skeet, Supporting Actress for Drew, and Best Director, but it did not win those. And then I wanted to mention, I don't mention these that often, but Fangoria Chainsaw Awards, they've been doing them for 40 years now. And I felt this one was appropriate because it is a slasher film. It won Best Wide Release. It won Best Actress for Nev, Best Supporting for Drew, and Best Screenplay for Kevin. And then again, Skeet was nominated. So, and then lastly, Scream is on the 1001 Movies You Must See Before You Die. Edited.
It should
by Stephen J. Schneider.
Yes. You got it right this week. So that was good. It was, it is just such a, so Nev, sorry, question. So is Nev in all four of the sequels? All five. Yeah. Is Sydney in all?
Yeah.
She's in the new one too?
I know she's in the new one, what but the? Is she in all four of the first four? Yeah. I couldn't remember if she was
in the only three that are in all of them are Nev, Courtney, and Arquette.
They're in all five of them?
Okay. Well, good, because isn't it, it's Friday the 13th where they kill her off at the beginning of the next movie.
Yeah.
And that's the way that used to leapfrog like that. We're going to get rid of her so we can focus on the
and
others.
Usually the fourth film is like a reboot where it's not any of them, you know. It's usually a new cast.
So. Right.
Nightmare did that,
It's a new cast with, like, their cousin or their you know, the son that Skeet had. Or
Nightmare Freddy's did that, too, except...
Child.
When they killed off Patricia Arquette's character from 3 and 4, it was played by a different person.
All right. I'll give him that one. What about Keys? We're into Key territory.
Yeah, we are.
We've mentioned some. Tyler, what about you? What keys you got?
Well, obviously the call coming from inside the house. is obviously a key.
Yeah.
That is a trope that has never really gone away. I mean, like you said, there's tropes that people don't do much anymore, like the whodunit. But right. There's always some movie that comes out, whether it's straight to Netflix or what used to be Redbox. There's always this call coming from inside the house trope.
Right. It originated in When a Stranger Calls, yes. 1979.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
The call is coming from upstairs.
Where's the kids?
I have that one. I have that one. I also have another one. This is an older film, but it is so imprinted on my mind from years and years ago. It's called I Know What You Did.
Ooh.
Is the name of the movie. And basically, it's two kids, two girls, and they're picking up the phone and prank calling people. And all they're saying is, I know what you did. But like the third person they call is this guy, and he answers it, and they go, I know what you did. And it pans down, and he's just murdered his wife in the shower.
Wow.
This I Know What You Did is the name of it. All right, I'm putting that down. I'm going to look that up.
But yeah, so that was one I had, but it's the same thing of the telephone being the to make us all freak out and be scared. Tim, you had mentioned the monk painting, of course, mm-hmm. is the mask. Psycho, which I thought was a great reference to. Let's kill the hair.
Mm-hmm.
Both the Agatha Christie's. What else do you have?
Well, I mean, you can't not have a slasher film homage and not include Friday the 13th. Mm. And they even do have a little bit of a body count, like when she sees Tatum hanging from the garage door, or when Courtney sees Kenny come over the windshield of the car. So we've got that. I'll go ahead and throw an obvious one out there, and that's Halloween, because I mean, there are so many references to Halloween in this movie. Mm. I couldn't keep track of them. I mean, they even use the music as accentuating music for a suspenseful scene. Mm. It's when she falls down the stairs and it's that dun 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 dun, and
well, and when she opens up the closet door, he goes dun dun dun.
Yeah.
I've got my key is one of the biggest meta moments is using the actual score and effects from Halloween mm-hmm. in the movie that you're watching.
Yeah. Right.
To augment it.
Right. And Drew Casey's parents, the husband turns to his wife and says, go down to the McKenzie's. And I'm like, oh my God, Tommy and Lindsay are there.
Yeah. Don't go to their house, please.
Yeah. Well, I've got, so I think, there's a lot of Halloween references. Loomis, the music, the effects, actually using the movie.
The knife that she pulls out at the beginning. Yeah.
Right. I've got, of course, Blockbuster. There was an homage to Blockbuster without ever seeing Blockbuster. It was interesting that they didn't want product placement, since obviously Dunkin' Donuts did during the movie. But it was, it brought back memories for me having managed one for years and years. It was very interesting, the Blockbuster. I've got one for you, Tyler, which was Supernatural. Mm-hmm. I don't think you would have Supernatural if Scary Movie had not been as meta as it was, because it led to those, except those two boys are the heroes as opposed to the two villains.
Yeah.
But it works very well in that back.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've never seen that. And when you said meta Scary Movie, did you mean meta Scream? Because Scary Movie is also a key to this movie.
That is very true.
Definitely. Scary Movie is a key, but no, Scream is definitely the key going to Supernatural.
Okay. Yeah.
I've got Mary Poppins, just because she does kill him with an umbrella. Although, again, it's one of those weird things of why does she put the costume on? It makes no sense.
I'm just dying to put a Mary Poppins link in the show notes. That's hilarious.
Well, I mean, you know that Mary every now and then wanted to kill both those little kids.
She was an evil bitch.
You know. Just,
yeah. Yes.
You know.
Yeah.
You know, just get them.
you want to go, Tyler?
Go. The other one that I had was just Wes in general. Wes isms. I think they even, if I remember correctly, they say it'll be some Wes something movie, but
Wes Carpenter.
Wes Carpenter. Yes. Yeah. They yeah. combine their movie, their names yeah. and, so it's probably going to be some Wes Carpenter movie. The little keys from not just like When a Stranger Calls, but the stalker key that is, you know, being stalked, being, manipulated into doing the wrong thing. You know, which door am I at? You know, let's play a game. I mean, Lord, they made a bunch of torture porn movies in Saw about playing a game. And,
that's a good key.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's one of the first that I remember of, aside from Freddy, quote unquote, toying with people. This is one of the first I remember of just the killer having fun. And that's what I think also adds kind of some fear in little Tyler who watched it, was this guy's enjoying it and who would enjoy this? Like, but I also kind of
would,
as in, I mentioned it earlier, Jaws was, in my last watch through with Madison with this movie, Jaws kept popping up like a key of Jaws, like the dead eyes, the phone acts like the fin, you know, it goes away, it comes in.
Yeah.
You know, that voice before you even see the ghost face, that, you know, the dash across the hallway, you don't fully see him, you know, stuff like that. It felt more like Jaws this last rewatch I did. So that's kind of
You inspired me because like Wes-isms, like as soon as you said that, the first thing I saw was that near the end of Drew Barrymore, Casey, whatever her name is, death. It's that very Wes Craven long shot with her running and him chasing. And all of a sudden it goes into slow motion for a few seconds and then speeds back up as he stabs her. That was a very Wes Craven moment, you know. And the fact that Nev does have a little bit of Heather Logan Camp kind of look to her and feel to her in places. The way she stands up to the killer and she gets forceful when she needs to get forceful.
Well, I can elaborate on that. I mean, he even rips off his own shot of when Skeet Ulrich is in the window. Johnny Depp does the same thing with Heather Logan Camp or Logan Camp, however you say it, in Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yeah. Yeah, very true. I did have you said music, and I have in my notes here, it's very unique. This movie has a lot of music, but none of it is thematic.
Yeah.
None of it is a theme song. Like, they use that really cool, slowed down, Don't Fear the Reaper for the sex scene, or the first seduction scene with Billy and Sydney.
These movies did wonders for Red Right Hand.
Yeah. It's got lots of good mood music, but there's no thematic. There's no Jaws theme. There's no Nightmare on Elm Street. There's no Halloween.
This was Weinstein selling soundtracks, basically.
Yeah, probably. I would imagine. So I thought that was curious. As a key, an anti key, I guess. The fact that they could get by without having a thematic for the killer or for the mood.
Yeah, I mentioned that to David Tyler about Red Right Hand. I wonder if that's like used more than any other song in movies and films and TV. Because it is definitely used in one of my favorite X-Files, which is Ascension.
I know when it comes on, if you come to where I work, we have this like, I think we've got it built now to like it's 78 hours of music on Spotify that just plays in our distillery. And one of the songs is Red Right Hand. And every time it comes on, anytime a song comes on, me and my manager, Brian, who you know, David, Brian Lowe, worked at the Opry. We say best use in a movie of this song. And I always, when Red Right Hand comes on, I say, Scream. Obviously, Scream. And he says, oh, no, there's this Will Ferrell movie. It's a comedy. He sings it. And I go, how dare you?
You have defiled.
I would be willing to bet there's a David Lynch one out there somewhere too that uses it. It wouldn't surprise me at all.
Me either.
Anyway, back to keys. Anything? I have a really frivolous one that's blatant.
Do it.
There's one directly to Clueless when Randy replies to Stu, "Oh, really, Alicia?" Meaning Alicia Silverstone and Clueless.
As if.
Yeah.
Yeah. When he says as if.
There's a key that it's somewhat of a story. It inspired two teenagers to kill their friends. Happened in Idaho. It's these two teenagers, and you can almost any murder mystery podcast or true crime podcast has covered it. It's called The Scream Murders. And it takes place in Idaho, and these four kids were hanging out, and now you can find on YouTube the two killers' home Sony tapes of them planning this entire thing and post, like, we just effing killed her. We just did it. We stabbed her 32 times or whatever, and, like, I killed her. Takes place in Idaho, and these four are hanging out. This 16-year-old girl is house-sitting for her family. And her boyfriend's over watching a movie, and they invite the other two friends to come over. And the other two friends say, this movie's lame. We're going to go to the movies. And they leave. But what the teenagers inside don't know is they went around and left the door unlocked downstairs for future use. And to scare them, cut the power for a little bit, then turned it back on. Then they, quote unquote, left to go to the movies. Well, she's so freaked out, the boyfriend asks his mom, can she stay with us? She's freaked out. She's here on this big house, out in the middle of nowhere, all alone. And the mom says, no, she can't. And so he ends up having to go home. And pretty much kind of like the opening scene, this ensues. And they brutalized this poor 16-year-old girl, very much like Stu and Billy did. And you can look it up. It's Murders Based Off Scream, and it takes place in Idaho. And it's terrifying, like, the entire process of, like, them planning and the videos they film of each other, like, we just did it. Oh, my God, I can't believe we just killed her. You know,
Did they use that as their defense?
I didn't watch the court cases. Influenced us? I didn't watch those.
Did they say her mother's a big slut?
Her mother's a slut, so we decided to kill her.
We had to do
that. Yeah, we had to. Yes. We blame the movies. Everyone else does.
Oh, my gosh.
So
that is just...
It's insane.
That's cool, man. That's don't know that we've ever had a real key. Yeah.
I found out about it listening to this podcast called Reverie True Crime. And
right.
The host tells the entire story of it, and, like, you can... So I then went and looked at, like, all the case and all that. I was like, oh, my God. Like, it really did. These two teenagers who were obviously messed up. I mean, these were friends. There's videos from their camera of all of them hanging out at their locker, talking, you know, out on dates and stuff like that. And I'm like, how can you kill this poor girl? Like, you were her. They were friends. They were, like, they were as close as... I would say me and Josh are. And I'm like, and they just killed her. Like, brutalized this poor girl. And she was found 2 days later by her family, who finally came home.
Wow. That's her boyfriend should have checked on her the next day. What's up with him? I'd suspect
and
him.
The mom not how do you feel how do you think the mom feels not letting her come over?
Well, if she had let him come over, they would have had the sex, and it would have been
and
bad.
And then she would have been the slut.
Yeah. You can't let these kids control.
Yeah, that's true. You really can't. These kids these days.
I actually have these another key. This one's a little bit better to go out on.
little I don't know. Down. That one kind of scarred me. That scarred me for life.
We talked about Drew Barrymore's performance in the opening of this movie, and it is like a textbook copy of Shelley Duvall's hysterics in The Shining. She is so good at convincingly being frightened. And I found out how they did it. Do you know this?
Okay. I do not.
Drew Barrymore is a big animal lover. And Wes taunted her with newspaper stories of animals being tortured, one in particular where an animal was set on fire, and whenever he wanted her to cry, he would take his lighter out and flick it, and he said she would instantly go into it.
Oh my gosh. I love directors who manipulate. It's so fun. No. But it's interesting because I did have in my notes that when they were in pre-production and everything else, she said, I really need to hear the voice. To do this. And he said no, but then hired the actor, put him in the house, in a room. In fact, she never met him ever. And so he really was doing the voice, and that was what she was hearing, was his actual voice on the phone. That's how she could react to it.
Cool.
Like, especially the one where she picks it up and he goes, "Don't you hang up on me, you bitch." Yeah. You know, and all that. And,
I got you like and a fish.
I don't think I have his name, but he did all five films, mm-hmm. that actor, that voice actor.
Oh, the mm-hmm. voice, the ghost face right, voice. Killer.
The phone voice, okay. Yeah.
Okay.
That's all I have for Keys. I do have a little bit of trivia, if you want, yeah. before we close.
Sure.
The use of caller ID increased more than threefold after the release of this film.
Like Tyler said, until they came up with the star thing,
seven or something like that.
If you want a meta key, Henry Winkler's Fonz jacket is hanging in the closet that he opens in the school.
Wow.
Oh, wow,
that's kind of sad. Do you think he brought it to the set to show people?
Yeah,
I was Fonz.
You want to touch it? You want to touch it? $5. You can touch it.
I need work.
I don't know if you know this.
And then lastly, I found this very funny. I'm going to read this verbatim because I think it's funny. And I don't know if y'all saw the credits, but if you did, you'll know what I'm talking about. The high school scenes were to be shot at Santa Rosa High School in California. Mm-hmm. However, very close to the shooting date, the school board read the script and denied the film to be shot there due to the violent nature, as they had been under the impression the film was a comedy. The production was moved to Heldsburg, California. As payback, director Wes Craven put in the end credits under the special thanks section, no thanks whatsoever to the Santa Rosa City School District Governing Board.
Perfect. Yeah. I love that. That's awesome.
And they're probably like, we could have been Woodsboro High. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, we could have gone down in history, but
right.
Now no.
We could have gotten extra funds for our football team. Five films now.
Yeah. There's one trivia that I always tell people when we talk about Scream is there's that last all that house stuff at the end is like that's 42 minutes of the whole movie is all at that house. Mm-hmm. And like sunrise to sunset, I have it written down here. I should have it memorized by now, but I want to get it right. So the party scene near the end of the film runs 42 minutes long. It was shot over the course of 21 days from the time the sun set to the time it rose. After it wrapped, the crew had shirts made that read, "I survived scene 118.
Mm-hmm.
Which was probably the entire scene. Yes.
Yes.
That's interesting. I did read, you just reminded me, I remember in my notes that the reason they could get that house was the owners of the house had actually died in the house. They had passed away, and the estate let them use that entire house for the month that they were.
Oh, you know, prepping my God. It just gets better. So this whole episode gets darker and darker.
It's like it's like its own little poltergeist.
Two people died before they filmed it, and a girl died because of two murders.
Yeah, it's got its own little poltergeist story following it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exorcist, yeah. Poltergeist.
Well, I don't know if y'all are watching, but Shudder has a series right now called Cursed Films, and the second season just debuted. Ooh. And the first one I watched last night was on The Exorcist.
Oof. Oh, yeah. Well, yes, definitely. Yeah. And we've covered mm-hmm. that. You know, when we did that episode.
Yeah, they even talk about Ellen Burstyn getting yanked and hurt on that. Remember us talking about that? I was like, we talked about that.
we talked about that already. So, Mr. Mack, where can people listen to this lovely Nerdist podcast of yours?
Ah, yes, it's the 30 and Nerdy podcast, and that's 30 and Nerdy podcast. And you can find it anywhere you listen to podcasts. We are on social media. You can go to our website, 30andNerdyPodcast.com, and you find our directory, all the nonprofits that we support, friends of the show, and where you can find our Patreon to support us and all that fun stuff. So best way to find us is 30andNerdyPodcast.com.
Perfect.
Awesome.
Excellent. We are so glad you joined us. This has been fun.
I have been listening to you all since, I mean, I know we go way back, but when you said me and Tim, an old friend of mine, are thinking of starting a podcast, I went, well, I'm going to listen because it's...
Well, we are honored you do, and honored that all of you guys out there in listening and watching land listen to us. And we hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, please subscribe, please click, please do all those good things. Give us a review, even if it's a three little word, hey, I liked it, or whatever. We would love to have your support on that. If you want to support us more, we do have Patreon over on the website. We have other podcasts that we do. One of those is on the X-Files, and one of those is on Classic Star Trek. So if you want to become a Patreon member, you can, for a cup of coffee a day, you can hear these great a month, whatever.
Not a day.
You always correct me on that, Tim. But maybe if they want to give a cup of coffee a day, we're fine with that. That would be nice, too. No.
as little as a cup of coffee a day.
Yes, yes. And definitely check out 30 and Nerdy. It's an awesome podcast for all you nerdists out there. And Tyler, thank you. Tim, thank you. Can't wait to next week.
We're winding down. This is number 38. We've got two more for the season.
Two more episodes in this season. Yeah, yeah. And Tyler, where are you guys in your season? Are you near the
middle? Oh, Lord. We usually run February to... around mid-February, late February to our finale is always a Christmas finale. Okay. So we're pretty early on in right now.
Good. Yeah. Good. All right. Well, thank you, guys. Thank you, Tyler. Thank you, Tim. I'll see you next week, Tim. Tyler, I'll hopefully see you this weekend in your show.
All righty.
Yeah.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.